All right. Hello. Are you on the line, Ryan?
Yes.
Great.
Yeah, I'm here. Great. Good to be with you, Fred.
Thank you so much for calling in. I know we're both eager to talk about these issues. We've been doing a lot of that in the last couple months, and I'm wondering if that are you seeing an acceleration of people interested in local food as sort of a political questioning of the status quo, the large corporations running the food programs? Is that gaining momentum?
I think it's been gaining momentum for the past couple of years, for sure. I mean, maybe even longer. The movement, the food movement in America, I feel like is alive and well. And yeah, I would say to go back, I would even go back 4 or 5 years, even further back. But the fact that even someone like Michelle Obama will, you know, sort of plant the garden at the White House shows that it's a very fairly mainstream movement, even.
Yeah, she took a lot of grief for it, though, didn't she? I mean, there was a lot of pushback for that garden, but she was able to at least not change the message too much. She did change the message a little bit. So you're seeing a gradual growth of interest in these issues, right? So that's good.
Yeah. No, I'd say, like, we do a broad range of community organizing, but food-related events are definitely, from the very beginning, when we started our project here in Boston, they're the most organic events in terms of people just come out of the woodwork for them. There's a powerful interest.
Hmm. So, Orion, this is Gary. I'm the sidekick around here.
Hi, Gary.
Hey. So, you know, tell me, in Boston, Scenic Hudson, which is a, you know, very strong environmental organization, has begun talking about the Hudson Valley, where we are, as the food shed for New York, that as this movement gathers more momentum, that should be a major understanding that we grow, a big thing we'll do here in the Hudson Valley is grow the food for New York City. Is there any similar kind of understanding around Boston? I mean, where do you go to get your food for your events?
Yeah, I think the understanding is emerging quite powerfully in New England as a region. And there's a certain artificiality to defining New England as a region, but there is also a historic reality to it. And there's a lot of conversation that's happening. It's kind of an interesting confluence of grassroots groups and activists, nonprofits, scholars, and even state agencies and government officials who are saying, how do we create a resilient food web at a regional level? Mm-hmm. And, for example, we started in the neighborhood where I'm most active, in Eggleston Square, which is a diverse urban neighborhood, people below the poverty line, some fairly wealthy condos, so it's a rapidly gentrifying neighborhood. We started a farmer's market, and when it was a neighborhood initiative, and when asked to define what they wanted to consider as local food for the farmer's market, people said, oh, we want to think of New England region, maybe even also inclusive of parts of New York.
Interesting.
So,
wait, I'm a second, Orion. Do me a favor,
sure.
Orion. Situate that square for me, because I went to BU and lived in Boston for a number of years, but I'm not familiar with that square. Where is it in relation to Cambridge and all, you know,
sure,
Somerville and all that?
So Eggleston Square is a somewhat neglected corner of Roxbury and Jamaica Plain.
Okay.
And when I say neglected, it's just because it cuts over various jurisdictions, so no one really knows who's responsible for it. You know, there's multiple elected officials who can claim it, and it's also been historically a hotbed of drug dealing throughout Boston, and is known mostly outside of the neighborhood for the violence that appears in the news periodically. But it's actually a very active group of people who live there, who are very close with each other, you know, from folks who've been there for 30 years to folks who are relatively recent newcomers to the neighborhood. There's a strong neighborhood association, and people are very active in the community.
All right. It's on my agenda next time I'm in Boston. Thank you.
I had a question about I thought it was interesting setting percentages. I know you have a program trying to establish 50% of the food you consume is consumed in New England. And I was wondering, where did the idea of looking at percentages rather than trying to attain full 100%, was that a decision that you all made, possibly an attempt to make this incremental, you know, building up people's reliance on homegrown foods. So how did this decision come into being, and why?
Yeah, so in some ways, that goes back to what I was talking about in terms of the confluence of academics and people studying the topic. So this particular vision that you're referring to was actually, it's published at New England Food Vision, and the lead author, Brian Donahue, is a scholar, a historian at Brandeis University. And he, I think, along with several other people, got the ball started in terms of just crunching numbers and saying, you know, if we wanted to go from where we are today, which is about 10% of our food grown in the region, and we want to get to a place that feels more in balance with where we need to be, and it's kind of a monumental task to go from 10%, let's say, to 50%.
Right.
Some people would say, oh, that, well, 50% is not sufficient. Let's go all the way up to 100%. And so there's some reasons why you don't necessarily, looking at history, want to go all the way up to 100%. I mean, at the peak of agricultural production in the New England region, there were huge environmental harms that were happening as a result of that. And you're also using a lot of land that you might want to preserve for wildlife habitat or for other purposes.
That's a good point.
Woodlots and other things like that. And in addition, you know, I think the other thing that Brian likes to emphasize, and I think it's a very important point, is when you think historically about regions that had no trade, they also, you know, no agricultural trade, they also frequently suffered famines. It wasn't necessarily the best way to create real resilience. So the question, not so much of being 100% self-reliant, but being relatively robustly self-reliant, and also part of your resilience has to come from having relationships with other regions. So if the weather in your part of the world goes sour for a period of years, you're not going to be starving. The other part there is that when you think about the, not just the land use patterns and the training new farmers and all the infrastructure investment and the, literally getting the capital to move into the agricultural sector that would take to get from 10% to 50%, but also the cultural change in terms of what it would mean to be so self-reliant, our diets would have to shift.
So in
the New England Food Vision that they constructed, they had various scenarios. They have what they call the Omnivore's Delight diet, which is relatively similar to, you know, like a socially conscious diet of today, where you might eat less meat and more vegetables, but you're not necessarily eating no meat. And you still might import your coffee and your oranges and your olives from around the world. But if you needed to push further, let's say because of peak oil concerns or whatever else, climate change, and if you wanted to go from the 50 to the 80%, they also have what they call a regional resilience scenario. And I think, again, their point is that if you want to sell a vision to people, you can't tell them that they're not going to have oranges or coffee anymore.
Right.
I mean, that's not really a very attractive vision. If by necessity we have to go there anyway, it will be helpful that we're already on the road to the 50% vision, you know. So then we might just go the extra mile to the 80%.
That brings up, you know, sort of a nightmare that occasionally occurs to me, to have everyone so dependent on their local food chain for food. I mean, how long would the average person, you know, listening to this program in the Hudson Valley, how long would they last if that food chain somehow broke down? You know, it would be a number of possibly of days before the families would start going hungry. And so is that that worry sort of part of this? Sustainability is certainly sustainability means less fossil fuels, something that you have more control over as a local entity. But at the bottom, is it also about protecting citizens in case the food sources are cut down or greatly diminished? I mean, I don't want to go on, but the average farmer in the Hudson Valley, he had enough food for months and months. You know, in September, October, he had a whole root cellar that would take him through with wheat and other things right to the spring. So is it also protection?
Yeah, I think that's what motivates a lot of people. And there's a lot of anxiety that we exist in a foodopoly and a corporate dominated food system. And supermarkets only have 3 days of food on stock.
Right,
and
right.
I think there's also just a sense that we're disconnected. Like, as you say, the average farmer, not only did they have food and supply stored away, but they also understood what it takes to make their own food, whereas, you know, 99% of us don't even cook anymore. You know,
right.
If you think about how much the culture has changed, like, cooking at home is considered a radical activity in America these days. You have teenagers who want to know how to make a meal. So there's a way in which we feel just that sense of disconnect by operating in the modern society as it's been constructed for us. And I think we want to reclaim our own sense of agency, our
right.
sense of relationship to the earth, our capacity to fend for ourselves. And I think food is a natural place where that anxiety latches on.
Yeah.
The reality, though, for Americans is that food is really, really cheap. And so even if we had a food shortage and food prices spiked in America, we're talking about, like, I think, you know, some small percentage of the budget now, maybe it's like 5 or 10% of our budget. And then maybe it bumps up to like 20 or 30 or even at worst case goes up to 50% of our budget. You know, that's rough, but we wouldn't necessarily starve under those circumstances.
Right.
I could imagine like an acute shortage, like for urban areas, if, you know, you had some sort of a reason why you couldn't keep trucking food into the city, and you could have an acute moment where, you know, and for those purposes, I actually believe it does make sense to think about what supplies do we have on hand and to think about storing water or food for like a month or so,
just
so you can feel like you could, or maybe it's just so you can share with neighbors in case they didn't store any food, you know, so you can come from a space of abundance and generosity under a moment of crisis rather than a space of panic. But so I think it does make sense for us to think about being prepared for emergencies. I mean, we're going to see a lot more crazy weather events. We know that's part of the package with climate change. So we ought to think about our emergency preparedness. But at the same time, I think the real issue is going to be more about the longer term sustainability of our communities, of the topsoil, you know, thinking about how are we going to shift our agricultural patterns to be more in balance with the earth and the world we want to be a part of. And I guess another piece I would throw out there is food is, you know, well-grown food that actually pays the farmer a living wage and treats the earth with respect is considered very expensive compared to the corporate food. And that's a challenge. And I think one of the things we have to think about, those of us involved in the food activism, is fighting for a living wage is part of this vision. You know, we need people to be able to afford to buy local.
Right.
And it's not, we don't want to pay the farmers less. We want to pay the farmers more so they can also have a living wage. So it's maybe stepping outside our just food focus and thinking about some of these other issues of extreme inequality.
Right. Well, yeah.
In America.
Well, thanks. That's really great. First thing I'll say that is, before we had you on the air, we were talking about, you know, what is it going to take for average person to get out there and speak up on a whole range of issues. And I think though, if you do your plan and take away people's coffee, that would do it. We would have, you know, insurrection in every town and city in America. But the question I was going to ask you, you sort of started hitting on it. I think people are more interested in food for a lot of reasons. I mean, you know, I have a friend, Ed Levine, who does New York Eats stuff. He's gotten to be pretty well known. And we, you know, his constituency are the foodies. And these people will, you know, go to the ends of the, you know, the Bronx to get a certain banh mi sandwich. But I think that sort of upper middle class focus on exotic foods and learning about new foods also can tie in that the challenge, like you say, is that people think when you say health food, that still has a certain negative connotation. My wife has various dietary restrictions, and things are so much better now. And I think more people are, you know, are cooking healthy foods that don't necessarily have a bland taste, that include a lot of, you know, can include a lot of things, not just, you know, counting grams of protein in them. So I think that's, I envision that this sort of foodie movement, which is rooted, I think, in a certain just, I don't know, middle class consumerism, but also has the potential to be won over by the sustainability argument. Is that? I mean, I didn't ask you a question in there, Orion, but I'm expecting you to answer it anyway.
Yeah, I guess I kind of agree that there's maybe another way of thinking about it is just food as a movement is alive and well, and different people in the socioeconomic strata plug into it in different ways.
I see.
But somehow it's really captured our imagination. It's like it's part of the cultural zeitgeist, so to speak, right now.
I think it definitely is. Yeah. No doubt about it. I'm going to sneak.
Also, I would just say the boutique operations that you see people sort of making their own honey or whatever in parts of Brooklyn, I think that's encouraging in the sense that learning those skills is reskilling is part of it.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think that's true. Attaching to the source. I mean, I used to teach Head Start kids who flatly did not believe me when I told them that milk came from a cow. They just refused to believe that. I showed them a picture and they said, "No way, you know, you're an idiot." And we actually had to bring them to the farm and show them the cow and being milked. And after they got over their initial revulsion, they understood this is actually where the milk comes from. But I think your average American may not have that level of disconnect, but we basically have this huge disconnect. Where does food come from? It comes from Stop and Shop, you know? And we really have to change that mindset, at least get people to think that extra level. Okay, here it is on my grocery shelf, but where did it come from? How did it get there?
Exactly.
All those questions.
I'm going to sneak in the last question because we have to finish up. GMOs, pesticides. Where does this come in? Does this give us a better leverage to control what's in our food if we, you know, have some oversight locally about how it's done?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the thing about the GMOs is that it's not that it's inherently wrong to modify crops. We've been doing that for centuries. It's when we do it for profit purposes that it becomes really distorted,
right?
And you get things like Terminator seeds and just crazy things like that, which serve no social benefit, but just enrich, you know, a small handful of mostly European men. So you have to sort of think about, the local movement is about ultimately related to local democracy, local power.
Huh.
And then it's also in reaction to the stagnation we see and the polarization we see at a federal level where, you know, it's only by forming relationships at a local level and creating the sense of connectedness that we can build a movement that might eventually have power to influence things at a national scale.
It's a template for other movements. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it's a template that we're all looking at since the politicians and Washington seem so controlled by the corporations. It is a template for having power when you're feeling powerless, I think. And it's an interesting template, too. So I want to thank you so much for being on. We held you a little bit longer, but I really enjoyed our conversation, and you'll be able to refer people to it going to classwars.org. They can listen to the entire interview. So I want to thank you for being on.
So if I go to Edelson Square and drop your name, Orion, do I get something? You know, will they say, oh, I'll say Orion sent me. And they're going to...
Unfortunately, yes. I think a lot of folks know me. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
They might even play into my house.
All right. Well,
thank
that's
you, guys.
Great.
It's been fun.
Yeah. Take it easy.
Thanks
now.
A lot.
Yeah. Bye now.